This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.
What I want to talk about is some research we've been looking at in terms of studying trust, both behaviorally and in terms of the neural systems that seem to be involved in trust decisions. But first, I thought I'd give you my brief kind of approach to neural economics, and this is going to be very brief given time constraints. But when I started doing economics experiments, we had this basic microeconomic systems approach to studying decision making in economic systems. And it basically said an economic environment together with an institution produced a microeconomic system. And that microeconomic system allowed people to send messages that could affect the outcomes that they might have in a market. So if it's an auction, it might be bid and ask and buy and sell messages or whatever. But whatever the institution is, it governs the message space that people have and the property rights they have and what messages they can send to the institution. But then it also computes from those messages, makes certain kinds of computations that lead to outcomes that people care about. And the nice thing I like about this model is that it's a very computational view of what an economic system is trying to do, that basically an economic system is performing computations in the world. Now, what I like about that is that's the way I view, and I think lots of neuroscientists view, the brain as well. That the brain is a system of neurons that are basically making computations. And those neurons are making computations that determine behavior inside the world as well. And so, for me, the natural thing about neuroeconomics is that this becomes a bigger computational system. That is, it recognizes that computation occurs both inside the brain and outside the brain. And part of the question is what gets encoded, what gets left over, what gets substituted for, what are the complements to the kinds of computations that occur in the world. So that's kind of how I view neuroeconomics. So what about trust? Well, as an economist, we were mainly interested in trust relationships as they dealt with exchange, the basic principles of exchange in economics. So by my definition, a trust is going to be a chance for two or more people to enjoy a mutual gain. It's going to have a first mover who has to take some risk in trying to achieve those mutual gains. It has to have second movers who have to decide whether or not to reciprocate that trust in order to compensate the first mover. And basically, I want to define a trust relationship then in this context of this definition as being when one through three occur, that is, when we can observe one through three occurring. Okay, so we wanted to put this into a game that people could play so that we could study it experimentally. So we came up with basically what we call the investment trust game, and this is with Joyce Berg and John Dickow. And it's going to be a very simple experiment. You're going to play the game once, do the task once. You're going to have a random, anonymously assigned counterpart. You're going to be given a random roll. You're either going to be the first mover or second mover. You're each going to start with $10 as a show-up fee. But the first mover who's making the investment can invest anywhere from $0 to $10 of the show-up fee, knowing that that amount will triple. And that's common knowledge in the experiment. Both parties know that the amount invested triples. Then the second mover has to decide how much of the tripled money to send back to the first mover. And that becomes the interesting question, because at the point that I have the tripled amount of money, it's completely in my discretion as to how much to send back to you. I could send back zero if I was so inclined. We made the whole process double blind, so we were trying to eliminate reputational effects and so on. So not only do the participants don't know each other in this experiment, but the experimenter only gets to record the total distribution of decisions and isn't able to identify individuals based on their decisions in the experiment. So here's the results. Let me show you for 32 pairs what we found. By the way, I should say that as a trained economist, sort of steeped in neoclassical approaches and the use of game theory, there's a simple game theoretic prediction of this model, and it's unique. The unique game theory prediction is, if you send me any money, I should keep it. And if you're going to keep the money, I shouldn't send you anything.
That's hard.
There's what actually happens. There's the amount sent by people, everywhere from $10. Here's our two game theorists. Sending zero. The amount triples, and this is important from an economics perspective, because those gray bars represent the gains from trade that people were able to achieve.
Who gets the surplus?
By sending the money. Now, remember, the money now belongs to person two, and they can do what they want. But they know that the only reason why they have that money is because you sent something that tripled. And here's what happens. So here's the reciprocators. These are all people who decided to send back, if not more, at least as much as was sent. The first thing you notice, by the way, is there doesn't seem to be any hardcore rule as to how much to send back, because that was never agreed upon by anybody to begin with. Now, at least that makes you feel good. There's the people who didn't send back money. This is a tough game. It's private, it's anonymous. People are behaving in their own self-interest. The fact that we got reciprocators at all was pretty amazing. Later on, we did a non-double blind where we debriefed people, and we were wondering about all these $1. That's the greater fool theory. I mean, I gotta send you a dollar just to show you how big a fool you were to send the money.
And then somewhat of an insult as opposed to a
game. Yeah, right. Now, what we did next was we took inexperienced players, but we showed them what that group did. Now, you could argue, if you know what this group did, you should perhaps notice that the average amount returned is less than the average amount sent. You should perhaps play more conservatively. But another model is, now that you know there are trusting and reciprocal types out there, that could affect the way you decide to behave in the experiment. And here's what happened. There's the people sending money. We actually get a slightly more amount sent. That's not the interesting thing. There's the number of people who reciprocated, and there's the number of people who defected.
So there's a decline in defection.
Right. So simply the knowledge that this game has trusting and trustworthy people, that trust relationships were formed in that previous game, seems to promote trust relationships in this game.
It's also worthy of note that the higher rate of defections are with the least generous first persons, as they concentrate on the right side.
Say that one more time.
If you look at the ones at 0 and 1.
Oh, yeah.
They're all people who got very little.
Now, under replications, this has been found to be true. We found very little correlation in the first set of data. But under replication, people are finding more correlation, and they are finding the principle that the more you trust, the more likely you experience high levels of trustworthy or reciprocity in the experiment.
You get a smaller fraction of that group than you want.
Right. Now, the last thing we did was we simply played the investment game twice. Now, as economists, we're interested in what would happen if people now believe there are trusting and trustworthy types in the environment in which they're playing this game. So how does the knowledge that those types exist affect your behavior in a two-player game? Well, here's the first period. There's the amount of trust. There's the amount of trustworthy behavior. So what you see is a huge reputational effect occurring in the first period. The most interesting thing about this reputational effect is if you look at this, all of a sudden, there is a modal norm to
to being seen as a trustworthy person, and that's to give back half the surplus. So all of a sudden, kind of equity comes into play, but it comes into play to establish your reputation for the second period. By the way, the one point I wanted to make in the earlier slides, especially that first slide, is while we saw trust and reciprocity is nothing to write home to if you're an institutional builder. If you were going to depend on that level of trust and reciprocity in the world to maintain economic growth or whatever, you would be sorely lost out. Now here, this looks much better. All of a sudden, we're seeing a lot more trust and trustworthiness in the repeated game, but this repeated game ended.
That's the second period?
Yeah, that's the second period. Okay, so even though trust and reciprocity were important to for people to be able to build that reputation, it became very strategic in this game. And what we see is that there are still trusting and trustworthy people in this experiment, but you can see what the reputation effect did in here. So this is what we learned.
The amount that they committed between the first and second round is there.
What's that?
The amount that was committed by the first player in the second round is about the same as it was in the first round. People did not account for that by shrinking the amount that they were putting on.
No, and in fact, if you try to build a standard game theoretic model of incomplete information and estimate types from the data, what you find is that it's the trusting behavior that's generating this effect, not the trustworthy behavior so much. It's the trusting types that actually allow this model to work. It's not the only model in the world, so I mean, I use that with a grain of salt. But okay, so now what I want to point to is a different study by Kosfeld and Hendricks and Zach and Fischenbacher and Fair in Nature, where what they did was they had people play the trust game, the one I just showed you, pretty much. But before they played it, half of the people got synthetic oxytocin sprayed into their nose, and half got a placebo. And then they gave them a few minutes for the oxytocin to take effect. And they were sort of curious, what would be the effect of oxytocin on the first mover behavior, the people that had to trust, that had to go first? Here's the result. Now, it turns out that's statistically significant. That's why they got it in the Nature. But you can see where most of this significance is coming from. It's coming on a boundary effect. And as economists, knowing more about econometrics, we would have required other statistical tests that probably would have failed on truncated distributions, but it got in anyway. But it is an interesting question. And the question is, does oxytocin, which is a hormone associated with bonding in mammals and in humans, affect the willingness to trust or approach another person in this relationship? Now, there's another problem here, which is the amount of synthetic oxytocin they gave them was not in equilibrium. This was an artificial change in the hormonal balance of the people that were making the decision. So it doesn't necessarily prove that this system would in any way be involved in moderating trust at this level. It does prove that if you give them enough of it, you can affect the outcome. Here's a very important point, though. And this is what made the study more interesting to me. They did a very important control, which is they also had people decide how much to send to a computer that would give them a random rate of return equal to the distribution that they got in the trust and trustworthy experiment. So all of a sudden, I'm simply gambling against the distribution. And what you see when they're gambling, you don't see this basic oxytocin effect of overinvestment. So it doesn't look like the decisions are simply some kind of amelioration of risk in the brain or whatever. And that to me was a much more interesting part of this study. So now I just want to show you some more recent work we've been doing with some people at NIH. Frank Krueger is the lead on this project. We did this at NIH because we used two scanners, and I'll go through the details in a minute. This was through Jordan Grafman's lab.
First, let me just give you a quick summary. What we seem to find is that people are using two different strategies to maintain trust in a repeated trust relationship. So now we're looking at repeated interactions of trust. There seems to be a conditional strategy that, if I were to name it from the behavior and from what the brain imaging seems to suggest, it would be the following, that it basically evaluates the trust relationship in terms of the situation and the temptations faced by one's partner. So you basically are very situational in the way you deal with things. What do we mean by more cognitively costly? Well, that's a little debatable, but it could either be in terms of what the model has to do to get this kind of trust to work, or it could be in terms of the number of voxels that were significant when we looked at the brain activity in the brain, and we see a lot more voxels being activated. Neither is a great measure, but it's the best we've got. And then finally, it does send a more mixed signal about the state of the trust relationship, because basically there's going to be times when you're not going to trust that other person because it's too risky. So it's more of an evaluative, situational type of trust. The second type of strategy seems to be unconditional. It seems to evaluate trust in terms of your relationship to the partner. It seems to be much more value-based in the sense that you get a very positive value of the person that you're interacting with. And then, basically, what we find as a consequence is trust is very unconditional. You trust all the time. And you would only break down that trust if in fact, you saw bad results from that unconditional trust. But you weren't making any kind of situational evaluation during the trust situation. Now I'll try to give you some arguments for why we think that's what's going on. First off, in terms of the game, this is a simplified trust game. So if you're mover one, you can choose to non-trust, in which case you get 5 and the other person gets 5. Or you can choose to trust. If you choose to trust, mover two can then reciprocate, in which case you get 10 and they get 15. Or they can defect and you get 0 and they get 25. Okay, so this is actually the reduced form of the bigger investment game around equal split.
Risking 5, 20, 15, or
25. Right. Yeah. The other thing we did down here is we varied the payoffs, and this is what's going to give us the situational context. So there's going to be times at which the temptation's going to be pretty high in this experiment with respect to what your counterpart can get if they choose to defect. We had a control experiment. I won't go into the details of why we needed it for the imaging. But basically, it lets us...
Can I ask you one question?
Yeah.
Why is it that you chose to make the sum in that second column always equal to the 0 plus the other one? I mean, you said 10 plus 15 equals 25. You could have done it 10 plus 10 is equal to 25, or 10 plus 20 equals 30. And so that what happens is this makes it a pure distributional game, but there's no additive gain or loss.
There's no gains to trade, is what you're saying.
Or from cooperation.
Right. We actually have another experiment where we've done some of that, but I'm just not reporting that today. But yeah. That's, here we are very much interested in the idea that the trust is actually designed to capture the gains from trade, you know, in the design. Let me show you the task. So we had two people show up. We took a picture of each one. They saw the picture of each other in the scanner. They actually were in side-by-side scanners at NIH. And so the first thing they did was they waved to each other in the scanner rooms, in their separate scanner rooms. Then they would see a picture of each other. And then it would be decision maker one's turn to move. They would make a move. And then it would be decision two's turn to move based on what one did. Then they would see the results, and then we basically pause for a second and redo this. Now what we did, which is also important, is we alternated roles. So if you were decision maker one the first time, you would be decision maker two the second time. Now one of the reasons why we did that is we're actually trying to promote large amounts of cooperation in this experiment, because we're interested in the systems maintaining trust more than what happens if trust breaks down, say, in this experiment. It's kind of a semi-block design. They ran 6 trust games followed by 4 control games, and we just kept repeating that. The only thing I'll mention here is, you know, we kind of broke it down into early and late stages of trust development. So stage 1 is considered early in the response, it's the first half, and stage 2 is the second half. Now, here's the first thing that we notice when we break the data down, is that you can basically split people up, and we did all kinds of sophisticated statistics to try to separate the pairs out, and then found out it was really a trivial exercise. Roughly half our subject pairs were non-defectors. That is, they never defected against their counterpart. Now remember, it's repeat interaction, and it's alternating types, and so on and so forth. This is the amount of trust, the amount of first mover behavior. And you'll notice by stage 2, there's almost 100% trust against a defector who's never defecting, or a second mover who's never defecting against you. On the other hand, these are all people that defected at least a little bit in the experiment against their counterpart. And what you'll notice here, interestingly enough, is trust, the percentage of times you trusted the other person, are correlated with the temptation, right? The more the temptation, the less you trust the person. Okay. Now, the first thing we were interested in, going back to some earlier work we had done, is the role of theory of mind, or the ability to mentalize what the other person was doing in terms of these trust relationships. And this is in the parasingulate cortex. We found this in other studies. Many people have found this for theory of mind studies. And it's basically, again, this idea that is there parts of the brain that help me infer your intentions in terms of mental simulation of the other person or whatever. And here's what we find. We basically find that the non-defectors start out with really high activation in this area. This activation falls over time, so by stage 2, they're not using it, or we're not seeing as much activation. Whether they're using it as a different question, unfortunately. What's interesting is the defectors start out with very, very low activation in this region, and then over time, their activation in this region is going up. Now, one explanation of this is that the non-defectors are using this early in order to get a picture of the person that they're dealing with, to kind of form a model of the person and how much they should trust them. Well, here they're not. But by the end, the defectors are much more using it more because the defector pairs are using it more because they have to know when the person's going to defect on them. So they basically have to use theory of mind more often later. The other thing we saw in stage 2 of the is a subgenual area. This is easier to see. Oh no, this is, yeah, septal area of the brain. So this is the area of the brain that's a heavy oxytocin receptor site in the brain. And so basically what we saw is that as the amount of trust and reciprocity increased, the amount of activity in this area increased as well. So this, together with the earlier Ferret et al. Results on, or Coatesfield et al. Results on oxytocin, at least strengthens the possibility that oxytocin is being used as kind of a trusting social approach mechanism. And here we're seeing more of an endogenous realization of that use. Ventral tegmental area, everybody probably is now aware of the dopamine system and reward processing, and basically what we seem to be getting again is that the conditional trusters or the situational trusters seem to be forming again more of a reward-related response function that's probably aided by theory of mind to establish the right expectations of rewards. The last thing I'll just talk about briefly is in an earlier study, we took 2,000 undergraduates at Arizona, and we gave them the Mach-4 test, which is a study of, it's an instrument that psychologists use to study, social psychologists use to study how instrumentally you use another person. So a high Mach is somebody who uses another person very instrumentally for their own ends. And we were interested in the differences in behavior between high Machs and, say, low Machs or average Machs in the population. So we resampled those 2,000 subjects and brought them back to the experiment based on their Mach scores. And so we had kind of selected samples based on the Mach scores. Here's the, I don't want to get too much into this, but here's the interesting result. If you're a high Mach, you behave no differently from the rest of the population as a trusting person. You establish the same amount of trust. But you can see that your rate of defection is almost twice as high on the defection side of this. Now, I want to caveat this with one point which I think is really important, which is we've collected data also on show-up rates of people that we asked to be in the experiment. High Machs always showed up. They were the most reliable elements of the population. So again, you know, if you're talking about institutional selection of types into roles, just because this person defects in a trust game doesn't make them a very useful member of society. When we go back to the dorsal medial prefrontal cortex, which seems to be an area involved in prefrontal control of alternative decisions, especially if there's cognitive conflict. This has been seen some of the work by Jonathan Cohen and so on. What we found, which was very interesting, is that if we took, so we also measured the people in the two systems of trust paper with the Mach test. And what we saw is that the higher your Mach score, the more active this dorsal medial prefrontal area was, so that basically there seems to be some correlation between sort of a cognitive control in whether to reciprocate or not and your Mach scores. Yeah.
Are you sure you got your dot in the right place there? Because that's medial frontal gyrus, not anterior cingulate.
It's actually, yeah, that's a bad picture. Actually, if I had the other pictures, you'd see it's more to the side. So, yeah.
Can I ask you about the theory of mind interpretation, or do you want to save questions?
Let's take questions at the end, because I think I'm almost done. So, yeah, so let me finish up with my storyline. I think, you know, in general, as a society, trust is both good and bad. Trust is good because it can increase economic efficiency by lowering transaction costs, a story that is repeated often. It seems to be innate, highly developed in personal exchange relationships. If I have time, I talk about the fact, though, that it also seems to be developmental and change over time in humans, which, you know, again, is an important story, but one I won't get into today. Furthermore, we seem to depend on these innate personal exchange abilities when we build our institutions to get them jump-started and working. The economic historians talk a lot about this in terms of institutional growth. But now on the negative side, it's a coalitional strategy. It's designed to find people to maintain a coalition with in these trust systems. And therefore, the institutions that we build are continuously involving stakeholders who are using personal systems of exchange to either subvert or change the rules of the game that they're interacting with. And so I think there's a real tension between the personal exchange nature of trust and the way it interacts with our institutions through the governance and coalitional structures that form around those institutions. And that's it. Sorry, I'm stopping. these are people in the lab.
Can you go back to the slide with the anterior cingulate and the crossover interaction?
Yeah.
So I'm a bit puzzled about, yeah, there you go, the model here. I would think that someone who's a conditional cooperator, they're going to be mentalizing, trying to figure out what the other person's going to do all the way through. And that someone who's an unconditional cooperator, they have the luxury of just saying, well, I'm just going to cooperate and see how it goes, and they don't have to do that at all. So I would expect that you would just have a main effect rather than this kind of more interesting, but I think, if I'm right, harder to interpret. What exactly is the reason for predicting this as opposed to just more theory of mindish kind of activity in the
Yeah. Well. Okay. First off, yeah, I would have loved to have said we wrote down a model that predicted this effect before we started. We actually thought your first hypothesis was going to be right in terms of the kind of theory of mind effect that it would. But what seems to be the story, right, is that this septal area of the brain seems to, in some sense, substitute for theory of mind. That's at least one interpretation. So that actually the increased oxytocin release and reception is, and that theory of mind may or may not have had to be used early in order to produce that.
The graph is that it gives you the level of activity in the paracingulate, right? Not in the subgenual.
Right, and these are beta estimates for individuals, right?
Right.
Right.
So if there's a kind of shifting from one to the other, then you would expect something like a nice, you know, inverse relationship between the level of activity in one area and the other, and that should be across the board, across both stages and types of participants.
Yeah, so we see no differences in subgenual area activations in stage one between the two groups of people.
And yet they're more trusting from the start, these
right.
two groups.
Well, remember, trust is high, fairly high throughout. If we look at the data, here's stage one trusters.
But the non-defectors, I mean, look at those error bars. The non-defectors are whopping the defectors in terms of trusting this. You know.
Right. No, I agree. But I'm not quite sure. So you're arguing that we should have seen earlier theory of mind by these people as well, I think.
I'm just trying to understand the relationship between the results and the model at a conceptual level. And,
right.
and it's two different things. This one is, why would you not just expect more theory of mind activity for the non-defectors than for the defectors across the board if they're applying these strategies consistently throughout? And then if the alternative to mentalizing is a kind of trust, then why would you not also consistently, you know, the invariant feature of this should be that when you've got a lot of one, you don't have a lot of the other, and you should certainly see more. So then you expect to see that, and you'd also expect to see more. If that's the trust area, then you'd expect to see more activity.
I can do better on your second part than your first part. I think the second part is an empirical question, and it has to do with how you think these trust behaviors are instantiated in the human brain. One possibility is you believe there's a types difference. That is, there are people who are just much more likely to form attachments to people, and that they'll, you know, end up using oxytocin systems to mediate that relationship. The other model is it's not a types; it's more of a effects result. That is, you know, because of a lot of early cooperation, the system comes into play, and that any pair, any person could have experienced that if they had been the high cooperation side of the thing. And that's something we can obviously run experiments on, and we're doing that to see if we can kind of separate a types explanation from a learning, you know, type explanation. Yeah.
You gotta be careful. I mean, between seeing things like a septal area and making arguments on oxytocin, we have no evidence whatsoever that, you know, that just that, first of all, that increases in oxytocin would lead to differences in activation and that region. The oxytocin is prevalent in the amygdala and all across the brain.
Right.
You know, we should be seeing it all over the place where we have oxytocin and blood receptors, and that's how it works. And I'm just saying this mostly for this audience, you know, because I think this audience doesn't know about, you know, the sort of caveats of brain imaging so much. I mean, I think it's nice to use this data in a way that, you know, to take what we know from other data and try to make a story, but this is not in any way, you know, a task that this particular interpretation is correct.
No, I agree with that. I think there is, the big problem in doing experiments of this type is any single experiment almost teaches you nothing. It's the combination of experiments. And the more you're relying on just imaging experiments, the less reliable any interpretation is, because you've not seen the details of the system at work. And so, again, if you have to rely on imaging as, and can't rely on animal experiments and so on, single cell firing and also neurotransmitter recording, hormonal recording at the cellular level, then, you know, there's some big leaps of faith in interpretation.
And I just think in general, I mean, just for this audience, you know, they start to interpret brain imaging data in their own work and hear more about it. It's important to recognize that all we know about, you know, what a brain signal means is what the behavior we measure and how we associate that to it.
That's right.
And we don't know anything more beyond that. And we can certainly use that information to then perhaps give ourselves hypotheses about what could be happening based on other studies that have been done, but it's not a proof of that behavior.
No, right.
And,
right.
You know, in almost no circumstances to prove that behavior. And so, you know, we just have to be a little bit careful and talk about it. And like, again, I, you know, I don't have any problem extrapolating, but only when it, the extrapolations go to an audience that they can prove something.
Right.
Then we might know that we didn't actually prove that.
Yeah, and again, right, there's a body of evidence that's being used to, you know, at least support the discussion, if not the conclusion. I agree. Yeah.
Well, I'm curious what role there is in your explanation for the participant's theory of the self rather than the other. That is to say, you know, I know you've worked with Claire Hill. She's doing this work on what type of person you think you are, right?
Right.
So it could be for at least some of these people, especially when the amount at issue is $10, and this makes my question a two-part question, that it's just not worth, you know, I might not care whether I get a response because it's worth $10 to me not to be a jerk. And that has to do with, you know, my emotional, if this is about the emotions, or my sense of myself is that, you know, I'm not, or any, and for some other people, the economists, it may be worth $10 not to be a sucker. So whether or not somebody else is going to send the money back, they may not send it out, right? And so part of, you know, the first part of my question is what role does theory of itself rather than the other, you know, that is to say, regardless of the response, here's what I think ought to be done, to be consistent with, you know, my conception of either ethics, if you want to call it that, or what I, being the type of person I am, ought to do. And so then the second part is, you know, does the amount of money matter? Here I think of the old Shamian joke about, you know, would you sleep with me for a shilling? No. Would you sleep with me for £1 million? What do you think I am? We've established that. We're just dickering about the price. You know, it does seem to me that dickering about the price can often be important. And while one may be willing to make a gesture, whether it's the gesture I'm not a sucker or the gesture I'm not a jerk with $10, one might be less willing to do that with, say, $1 million.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I'll answer them in reverse order. The scale of the money incentives, you know, is always an open question. Now, partially the answer is, if you believe it's an important question, test for it. You know, people have done that in the ultimatum game. There have been some high stakes trust games now run with fairly high replicable results, in at least in the repeated games of trust and reciprocity. So high stakes seem to be working there. The second thing I want to say about stakes, just real briefly, is, in a way, I think this is a great neuroeconomics question, because the one thing we seem to be seeing in the brain in terms of reward systems is in the brain is that the brain has to come up with the sort of the range of rewards that are relevant, and then it almost rescales things in terms of that system into the scale of rewards that are essential. And so I think we often, when we make these questions about scale, we often switch back and forth in our stories in a way that the brain doesn't. That is, you know, we want you to go to the other scale and back again and so on to find it amusing or humorous, you know, philosophical point to make about somebody's standards. But the brain has to make a real choice as to where to normalize that and then how to take the normalized incentives as a thing to learn from. And I think that's, you know, a key point that some of the reward processing literature is coming up with. On self-other, there's a lot of work that I didn't have a chance to talk about today by Reed Montague at his lab and his graduate students that are looking at the role of the cingulate cortex in terms of sort of these theory of mind or evaluation of self and other type activities. And there's very interesting work there. I recommend reading it. I think it's still an open question. You know, when philosophers started talking about the theory of mind stuff that was coming out of psychology, they immediately came to this question of, well, is theory of mind my simulation of you in my brain, or is theory of mind some basic categorical, you know, concept I have of another person that somehow instantiated in the brain? And, you know, I think reading some people that read stuff would argue that the singular results seem to suggest more of a simulation theory of mind, which I suspect neuroscientists would also find slightly more appealing in general. And then the question is, how does experience affect that? Like, you know, I find it very interesting that our high mocks were just as trusting as our low mocks in the world. That's something they had to learn, is my guess. Is that the world is not like them when it comes to this situation.
I'm not sure you have. I mean, I don't know whether you've gotten to the answer to my first question, but
there could be. I thought you were asking about
not asking
the self-other relationship in terms of how I view intentionality from my self perspective.
I'm saying that behavior might be, whatever my theory of how other people will behave, I might have a view of myself and how I ought to behave, or even an emotional sense of, you know, what I'm comfortable with doing, right? I don't care about as much about my projections of what other people might do. It's what's consistent with my image of myself. Whether that, you know, whether or not they're going to send it back to me, I couldn't, to exaggerate, think with myself if I didn't send it to them.
In other words, what you're calling trust here may not really be trust, but just a kind of a willingness to suspend disbelief or something like that.
Or a sense of, it's not about what they're going to do.
Right.
It's about who I am and what I'm going to do.
So there's two ways to think about that, though, in the first mover position. If I'm the truster, do I trust you because I, as you, would be a trustworthy person? That is my self-image of myself that I would be trustworthy and therefore I should go ahead and trust you? Or is the image that I'm just a trusting person and I refuse to let my concern about your untrustworthiness affect my willingness to see myself as a trusting person? Those are two interpretations of what you're suggesting.
Or it might be orthogonal to trust, which is why I use the terms like jerk and sucker, right? Sucker is about trust and the lack thereof, but jerk, you know, to not be a jerk is, you know, if I'm not willing to send it to you, that may be because it may be saying something about what I'm thinking about your trustworthiness, and it may just be saying something about what I think about.
So the 50% that sent less than $5 didn't worry about being jerks, and the 50% who did.
Well, I mean, I guess I'm wondering, like, did you interview people about their
We debriefed them in follow-up single-blind experiments just to see how people interpret the game. We just asked an open-ended question, what do you think this decision problem was about? And something like 90 to 95%, actually, I can't remember the exact number, used trust in the debriefing statement, so, you know, I think that was a pretty strong.
But how could your friend The question that could be a priming effect. The other thing is, like a minute ago, you said, well, why couldn't they just want to hold this view that I'm a trusting person, so whether or not you're going to send it back to me, I'm going to be a trusting person. You've now changed the definition. They're not talking about trust. They're talking about generosity.
Yeah. Right, that I'm a generous person, and therefore right. I expect you to be a generous person.
No,
I'm
going to send you the money. It would be nice to be able to trust you. I might know better.
So I want to, what you're saying is,
the generous person I'm willing to take.
What you're saying is, I don't care if you don't reciprocate.
Yes. But not right. because I trust you, right. but because of how yes. I want to see myself.
Yes.
As for
that's
yours, and I get your point.
Okay.
The thing is that depending on your culture, whatever, mm-hmm. what is a jerk?
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
It's pretty darn different because
yes.
I'm not one.
So the debriefing questions said that basically people were
right. right. No, that's, what it's, that's why I right, right. use terms like suffer a jerk.
But, right, and I think what's really going on is projection.
Yeah. Right. Kevin, what's your mock? The mock readings sort of try to this way because you have various individuals scored differently on that particular test.
Right.
Presumably, that would be in some way, shape, or form a proxy for self-image. And if there's no real variation in the initial offer, what based upon their mock yeah. scores, then
that's a possibility. In which case, we'd be better off. But I think social psychologists might argue that it's the wrong proxy for self-image. That there's a different notion going on there. The best we have is basically, here's a possibility. Ernst has run experiments where when people don't trust, you have the option to punish them when they're not trustworthy. And people punish a lot. So it seems like the expectation is for reciprocity, not for self-image in the sense of, I want to be a generous person. Because a generous person wouldn't feel the need to punish you. If
the theory is generosity, but if the theory is there is a norm of appropriate behavior that I'm going to abide by regardless of whether you do, and I expect you to abide by, so I'll punish you if you don't.
Well, yeah, but that could explain anything. That's just take whatever behavior we observe and say that's the norm, and we're done.
Did you divide them into high, low, and middle, and throw off the middle in order to maximize the differences?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Because it's well known that the mock test works best as a population, that individual differences are pretty large.
So I'm wondering how you apply this. You know, I keep thinking of one of your slides specifically made me think of anybody who might have just written the L a couple of times ago about the shell game, right? And in the shell game, you're going to win the first time, maybe even the second time, and then you don't lose.
Right.
And I'm also thinking about, for example, the Nigerian phishing scams where people try to get you to give them a lot of money, cash, send you a check. How do you apply this?
Yeah, well, actually, I think the question, Ponzi schemes are even a better example, where you're in a repeat interaction with somebody and they provide you, it's where basically I'm adding people to the scheme and I'm using their money to compensate for earlier people, and then using that as proof that people are getting a return on their investment, and I'm just redistributing money long enough to get enough money to walk away from the deal. And so there you have people that are experiencing constant, over a reasonable period of time, reciprocity, and willing to announce that to other people, and so on and so forth. So I think, can you take advantage of these trust systems? There's no question about it. I think the fact that in our one-shot trust case, you saw such high variation in the amount of trust and trustworthiness people were willing to exhibit, that's probably socially a very good thing. What's a little scarier is that repeated game one where they
Well, that's why I think interpretation of the first one is off.
Right.
Or maybe I'm just jaded enough to think that it really is a shell game and that was the plan and they did educate it.
Yeah. I think there are people taking advantage in that repeated game, the two-period game, of the types that exist, the trust and trustworthy types. We see them acting perfectly trust and trustworthy in the first period and then you know, not in the second period. But that only works if we all believe those types are out there in some sense. It wouldn't work if we didn't believe that there were really trustworthy types.
We're going to have to stop that. Yeah. So you would need another personality variable included if you have a 2x2 in order to attribute people's view of themselves on some context along the Dimock scale to get a better idea, I think.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.